Support for this episode comes from Team Pennsylvania, hosting the Pennsylvania Hemp Summit, two events in 2022 offering a place for farmers, professionals, investors, and policymakers to learn and connect. Details at pahempsummit.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Maya Dalla Valle. We'll talk to Maya about generational change, Napa, and of course, Dalla Valle. We'll taste the Dalla Valle Colina for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Maya Dalla Valle was born in Napa Valley. Grew up in a cult winery, and even had one of those cults named after her. Maya lost her dad at a young age, left town to study international relations, and eventually came back to Napa. But first she received two master degrees in wine, one from Cornell and one at Bordeaux Agroscience. Maya then put her boots on the ground, traveled and worked at some of the finest wineries around the world, including Patrus, Latour, and Ornellaia. She returned home to her mom, Naoko, at their eponymous winery and oversees all wine growing and wine making at Dalla Valle Vineyards, along with her new project, DVO. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Maya.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's a pleasure to be joining you this morning.
Yep, looking forward to talking to you because big Napa fan and an old drinker of your wine, so this is nice. So we're talking to Maya remotely via our app, Zencaster. Maya, where are you right now?
I am in our winery.
Okay, which is, yeah. Tell me exactly.
So we're on the east side of Napa Valley up on the Vaca Mountain Range and right in Oakville, so right in the heart of Napa Valley.
Okay. A little down the road, I want to talk specifically, you know, about the plot of land you're on, you know, with everything that involves it, climate, soil, but we'll get to that later. All right. Okay. So help me with a little background and set up things for my listeners a little. Let's talk about the winery first, because it existed before you.
It did exist before me.
So let's set that up. So your dad, Gustavo, was Italian, and your mom, Naoko, is Japanese.
Yes.
So I'll remind you, forget, how did they meet? How did wine become their life? I mean, did it precede them in any ways as something they found together? And how did they wind up in the eastern hillside of Oakville, you know, which is currently mm-hmm. where the vineyard is in Napa. So yeah. Tell me how all that came together.
So my father originally was in the scuba diving business. So he co-founded a company called Scuba Pro, which is still in existence today. But he sold that company and was still living in the West Indies because he was very involved also in the diving industry. And he met my mom on a business trip to Tokyo, and it was one of those, you know, love at first sight, and that's the end of the story kind of situation. So they
that
were living
quick,
in the West
right?
Indies. Yeah, yeah, very quick. I guess when you know, you know. So they were living in the West Indies, and at a certain point, my mom wanted to have a family, and it's not really the best place to do that. And at the same time, they also, yeah, because for me, it would have been great to be raised in the Caribbean, but, you know, the school, you have to fly out to go to school. You go to boarding school right. at a really young age. Logistically, it's more challenging. So they also had this opportunity to invest in a Rillian Chateau type of business. And they were given two choices. One was New Orleans and the other was Napa Valley. So it's pretty obvious which one they went for. Mm-hmm. And came to Napa Valley in 1982, but without realizing that a majority of the Napa Valley is within what we call the agricultural preserve. And that was put in place in 1968 as a way to protect the beauty and nature of this valley from overdevelopment after seeing what happened in Silicon Valley and so forth. So it was quite challenging then to find a perfect location to build that kind of business. But in the meantime, they had fallen in love with the area and, you know, loved the beauty of it. And my father had some experience in wine, very basic, because my grandfather had a winery in Alto Adige. I don't know the name of it. And I don't know much about the winery, but my father had some limited experience in that winery in Italy, although I wouldn't say it was really transferable. So it was still kind of like starting from scratch when they decided to go into the wine business. So they fell in love with this specific plot of land where our vineyard and winery is now, because of the view. So my father, being Italian, he wanted to be on the hillside. He loved the beautiful view of the valley. If you ever get a chance to come up and see us, it's this big, expansive view of the Mayacamas and the valley floor. So purchased it. With that, there was about an acre or two of grapes planted. And they were being purchased by Camus. So Chuck Wagner came up and introduced himself and asked if he could continue buying the grapes. And my dad, to my mom's shock and awe, said no. And then he said, no, I'm going to make wine instead. And so my mom was like, well, what do we know about winemaking, you know? So she always jokes like it was stepping on a banana peel and sliding into the wine industry. So
pretty good slide, though.
Yeah, I know.
So they went out, chalet and whatever that is. That's like hotels, right?
Hospitality. Yeah, like a boutique hotel.
Went out to do that. And did they ultimately do that and then shifted towards wine? Were they running both?
They never
at the
made
same?
It to that.
Oh, they didn't. Okay.
No, gave up on that dream. Yeah.
And so, your mom had no background or even interest in wine? She kind of took
They enjoyed wine. They both were both wine appreciators and lovers, but no formal training or experience in the industry.
All right, so we're going to talk about, you know, early vintages and all that. But now I want to talk about you for a minute. So you grew up on that property, on the vineyard, right?
I did.
So tell me about, because you don't realize then what you know now. Tell me about growing up in the vineyard. You did lose your dad at a young age, right?
Yeah, when I was 8 years old.
Tell me, you know, a little how that changed the life and even the wine thing. And I'm just curious, you know, were you one of those people who had a good relationship with her mom or, you know, good enough, but a little, tell me that, how that was. Because it was really you two. You were the nucleus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, my mom and I have always been very, very close. And of course, after my dad passed away, it became even closer. You know, I'm first generation American and we have no extended family in the United States to speak of. So, yeah, so it was really just her and I. But, you know, she was also faced with this decision after my dad passed away, if she would continue and take on the business and keep carrying it on or, you know, sell it and go back to Japan. But
what year was that? And how long?
That was 1995.
And how long was, you know, the vineyard around and how many vintages were you up to about then?
So the vineyards were planted in 82 and we had our first vintage in 86 of Cabernet. Sick. So it was almost a decade at that point. And it was also a pivotal moment because at that time, the 92 vintage of Maya, which was just about to be released or was just getting rated, received a perfect score from Bob Parker. And so that was very pivotal for us because my dad also knew, he learned about the rating just before, like a month before passing away. So he kind of knew, left us knowing that, you know, things were going to be okay. So my mom, She felt
so the timing was great. As far as the Parker thing, not your dad.
Of course. But it was that the timing was kind of pivotal. And my mom realized, you know, we had a really good thing going. So she had already fallen in love with, you know, growing grapes and making wine and the whole business, and felt a strong tie to the community here. So decided to really take on the business and really elevate it to the next level, to take it to where it is today. Because it's really just been her for a long, long time until I came back.
All right. So I'm going to talk to you specifically about, you know, vineyard practices, cellar and mm-hmm. all that. But before we get to that, the winemaking, did your dad do it initially? I know your mom became a winemaker. I mean, who was making you had consultants. Who was making the wine, you know, the first 10 years?
Yeah, we always had an in-house winemaker. So our very first winemaker was Joe Cafaro, who was also the winemaker at Robert Sinsky in that right. era. And then after a few vintages, he just became too busy. So we hired Heidi Barrett, sure. who was with us through 95. And my father was always very involved in both aspects, in the vineyard and in the cellar. But because right. he had no formal training, we definitely needed someone who had, you know, the background right. and guidance to make sure nothing got too, you know, awry. But, and my mom was always involved very much on the business. She was running the business side. But then after my dad passed away, she had to start overseeing everything. But then always made sure she put a really good team and invested in having a great team in place to guide the wines and vineyards along each year.
Did she supervise that, or she was pretty heavy-handed in making the wine? I mean, beyond opinion, but...
She was overseeing, I would say, more okay. than being, hands-on. Mm-hmm.
So with all this going on around you, when did you realize that wine, you know, would be your path in life? I mean, I don't think it was as a little kid, even though you're running around the vineyards. And, you know, I said you kind of left town, not even to study wine, but eventually, you know, did. When did, mm-hmm. you know, when did that solidify?
It really solidified when I left Napa Valley. it was, I think when you're surrounded by too much of a good thing, it's way too obvious. And you think, you know, this can't possibly be it for me. When in fact it really was. So it took me, you know, removing myself from the Napa Valley. I went to undergrad at University of Washington in Seattle to right. start to think about, A, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And B, how much I actually felt a lot of sentimental attachment to this property, because it was something, you know, my parents started together and right. my father passed away. So I started to realize the importance and significance that this vineyard and winery had in my life. And so that's when I started to pursue a career in wine.
Did you finish 4 years of college?
I did.
And did you take a job in, international relations? Or that's when you realized the wine thing and just started pursuing that?
Yeah, I graduated in 2009, so that was really in the midst of the recession. Right. So I had an interest in, you know, joining either Foreign Service or working for an NGO, and it just was not, the opportunities just weren't there. And so I decided, what can you always do is work harvest, because there's, you know, it happens every year, and good times or bad, there's always wine to be made and consumed. So I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to work at Nyers Vineyard. So Bruce and Barbara Nyers are sure. like my extended family, have been a really big part of my life, and gave me the opportunity to work in their winery. And that's when it really clicked for me that, you know, specifically not only just wine. Yeah, it was amazing. Tadeo, the winemaker there, took, you know, a lot of time to explain to me everything and show the different vineyard sites and soil, learn about soils and winemaking and, you know, all the above, every step along right. the way. And I just was fascinated with every aspect.
It roped you in. I want to ask you a couple of questions that kind of set up to what you're doing and where you're going. but we talked about it a teeny bit. Can you discuss how you understood the wines your parents made when they started the winery? I mean, what was their vision? What was the type of wine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I know that, you know, in a sense, you guys are red wine specialists. And then you brought up Parker, and I want to know if the presence of Parker had any effect on the wines they made, you know, if they kind of changed to, you know, appeal to him, or that's the wines they were making. So what did they set out to do?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like I mentioned before, they're both, you know, great wine appreciators and drink a lot, predominantly old world wines in their earlier times. But for them, they really set out and set a vision from the beginning, which I think has been a big factor in our success, is making, you know, terroir-driven fine wines, and making, the goal was to make a great wine of the world. And so in order to do that, you know, you can't cut corners, you have to make sacrifices and really keep that vision aligned with your team. So, and even with, Parker, it wasn't, we were always very true to what the vineyard site drove every year in each vintage. And if there was, you know, different winemakers over the years. And of course, there's a natural evolution in the style of wines. Right. It would be strange for it not to evolve, but it was never meant as to be a wine to appeal to one critic. So it wasn't that we were always even rewarded for what we were doing. But we can always say, like, we're very true to the vision of making a great wine no matter what. Even right. if it meant not always being able to appeal to the masses.
Well, when you alluded to old world, you know, that your parents admired those, was that more Bordeaux than Burgundy, more Burgundy than Bordeaux? Was it Italians? I mean, what do you think it was?
I grew up being able to try and taste a number of different wines, and it was all the above. It was Italian, okay. you know, Barolos okay. or Tuscan wines.
A lot of those have a hand in influence, you know, of the type of wines that you're making. So your market was guys like me, you know, middle-aged collectors, you know, who had a little money, you know, were informed, like, these guys are happening or these guys are getting ratings. But guys like me were starting to get older. Have you seen a shift in the consumer? Have you made an effort? You know, is that the market you still have to play to? They buy most of it. I mean, where is that going? Because, you know, you're generationally, you know, next up.
Mm-hmm. It's a mix. Actually, you know, I have to say more and more of our customers are younger in age or signing up and are becoming more interested in our wines because we have, you know, three wines in three different price points. So it gives a greater accessibility versus if you're just making, you know, one really expensive wine.
Right.
And of course, we still have our, you know, the core of our consumers are older and they are getting older, but I'm pleasantly surprised to see more younger consumers interested in our wines because they have more disposable income now. They also are taking more of an interest in wine, and then also not just in wine, but, you know, how the wine is made and more conscientious of this. Yeah. And, you know, if it's sustainable, is it organic? Do you?
All right. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about that.
Okay.
All right. Because I think, you know, you're doing good things that way. You know, as I mentioned, you're a second generation winemaker. And you said that as different winemakers came in, you know, obviously everyone had a vision and that would, you know, have an effect on, you know, vintages and where the wines were going. That's mm-hmm. that's in your lap now. So
yeah.
I'm sure you have your own vision and ideas for the winery, also with respect to, you know, what's been done and, you know, continues to be done. Tell me about the things that you're doing. You just popped off a couple of them, and things that you, you know, want to get done that maybe you're not there yet. Mm-hmm. you know, what comes to mind? Like, what are the things? I mean, I don't want to answer the question. I know them, but I want you to. So tell me some of the things that you're doing.
Yeah. So after, unfortunately, we had to replant the whole entire vineyard between 99 and 07. And it was due to a number of factors of virus, disease, and that just became so insurmountable that we had no other choice but to replant and start over again. And that was a very difficult period to watch.
Wait, does that change the rootstock you plant, or do you just plant the same stuff?
We did make some adjustments in terms of row orientation and rootstocks, but the plant material itself, we work in a muscle selection, so we take our own cuttings rather than working with clones.
Right.
So genetically, it's all slightly different and gives more heterogeneity to the vineyard, which I think is advantageous against virus and disease. But
Continue. You had to replant.
Yeah. We had to replant. And then after we replanted, my mom decided to start farming organically in 2007. And that's been a huge change and impact on the quality, I would say, and health overall of the vineyard. So when I came back in 17, after being in Europe for 3 years, I had the opportunity to work and see and visit different estates that farm biodynamically. Right. And just thinking about, you know, for me, what's going to be my legacy and what am I going to do to carry things on to the next generation would be about not replanting again. Like how I see the value in old vines, Europe, it's highly valuable and they don't even believe that vines do anything interesting until 20 years. So for me, I started thinking about, you know, what is it that I can do to really help guide this vineyard and keep it healthy for 50 years without having to replant it. And biodynamics seemed like an obvious choice and something.
So can you just clear something up for me? You know, I've read over and over that in Napa, you know, a lot of the vineyards are replanted. I mean, you had a specific reason, but I think there's like a shelf life for Napa. And I'm guessing because that's the way the vineyards are treated, literally, you know, treated. What you're saying is by going organic and you're talking about eventually biodynamic, that is much better for the soil and the plant. And that gives you the opportunity for the plant to live a much longer life, which we both know older vines. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, banks here depreciate vines after 20 years. So that's pretty, it gives you an insight about how valued old vineyards are because the yields go down and they're not as productive and they're older. But for us, we see the value and the quality going up. And we're just starting the fourth season of farming biodynamically. And what we love about it is that you really start to look at the system as a whole. You don't look at an individual vine. You look at, you know, the ecosystem around it, the soil health and, you know, biodiversity. And how do you create a self-sustaining system and keep all the, you know, those factors of health in place? Because it is a monoculture. It's not like you can rotate crops every year. It's a one crop over and over, you know, for many, many years. So that's what I really appreciate about the philosophy of biodynamic farming is thinking about health beyond the vine.
So you're doing ram's horns and moon cycles and all that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So is it, I know you and I'll agree it's worth it. But is it harder, or you just do it and it becomes part of the routine and that's that?
Yeah, I mean, it puts you in the vineyard, you know, one additional time per month, I would say.
Okay,
and I think,
worth it.
You know, there's definitely no harm in that. You need to have a team that's also open-minded and on board with it too, which is, we've been very fortunate, you know, everyone has embraced biodynamic farming in our team, so... And it's just like a way to bring people together and just, you know, bring a certain energy into the space, which is, I think, pretty unique. So, I mean, in terms of difficulty, it's really not that difficult.
Right, which is great.
We're in a Mediterranean climate, you know. We don't have huge pressure of mildew in the area. That's not our main issue. So
to that point, which is a good point, because it ain't Champagne and it ain't other regions, you know, they have a lot of moisture. I don't get why more of the valley isn't making the changes. Now, you'll probably argue that they are, but do you think Napa as an area is committed to the things you're doing as deeply as you are?
I think slowly the narrative is starting to change. I think, you know, to get a whole region on board on doing something is, you know, a lot. And for some people, it's more challenging financially or economically than for others.
Right.
But, you know, you can start. And there is an initiative with there's a program called the Napa Green Program as a way to start having people in the valley or having Napa Valley collectively start thinking about sustainability, climate change is, you know, in our face. It's, you know, undeniable. And what are the things that we can do to also encourage other farmers or growers or wineries to get on the same page? Because I think the writing's on the wall. You know, if we don't do any change or ignore the changes in front of us, it's only going to get worse. So I think I think the attitudes, especially, you know, I would say in my generation with my colleagues in the valley, are all pretty much on the same page in terms of sustainability and moving away from using harmful pesticides and herbicides and trying to take at least, you know, one step away from it.
All right. So that's at least happening. Cause you know, I was going to say you're very diplomatic and even call a little BS on you, because you are the one who accurately stated you're in a Mediterranean climate, which doesn't necessarily call for this stuff. So why were people doing it anyway? You know, for bigger output, you know, make their life easier. I mean, you're right. I mean, financially could be a hardship, but everyone, you know, should take a step. And, you know, kudos to you for doing it, going all in. And, you know, your winery is so influential, hopefully that it'll, you know, encourage other people to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a dogmatic person, right? So what I believe in, you know, it's kind of leading by example. I'm not going to go around to like someone whose livelihood is their 5-acre or 10-acre vineyard and tell them, you need to farm the way I do, because it costs a lot more. And maybe at the end of the day, they still can't sell their grapes for a price that would, you know, economically affect that or reflect, you know, the quality of farming they're doing. I would say, but on the other hand, going to like a big corporate group who can certainly afford to farm organically, then you can put the pressure on, absolutely.
So
it just, case by case.
Yeah, I agree with that. And in the end, that's the right way to approach it.
Right.
Do what you know is right and lead by example. So you're talking about, what'd you say, 4 vintages of biodynamic farming, did you say?
Yes. Yeah, we're
so
just starting the 4th
season.
Can
you sit there with the 4 vintages and tell me if you could, you know, notice differences or the effects on the wine? Is it subtle? Is it obvious? What is it?
So, I mean, they say it takes 2 to 3 years to really begin seeing a difference. I'm pretty thorough, and I like, you know, data and numbers and science too, to kind of help verify things. So I would say since the 4th season we're starting, we haven't made the wine yet, obviously. We're just starting bud break. But for the other 3, there are 3 very different vintages, 19, 20, and 21. So I would feel more comfortable to say in 5 to 7 vintages from now, be able to make a more accurate description of how biodynamic farming has changed the wine. I can already tell you that vineyard-wise, we start to see things in the vineyard that they're able to withstand more heat, they hold water better, you're starting to see a change in the vineyard. But I would be more comfortable to make commentary about the wines having, you know, go a few vintages down, because you don't know what's vintage effect and what is effective biodynamic farming.
Right. So you're meticulous about growing grapes. I think, I don't know if it was your mom or somebody, but somebody said there's a difference between wine growing and grape growing, right?
Yes, that was Tony Soder who said that.
Oh, it was Tony Soder? And Tony had worked with you guys, you know, in the old days or something? So
yeah,
what is the difference?
Tony Soder and Nia Klein worked with us. So he was the one who really put this idea into my mom's head and to have her understand the importance of grape growing, but changing it to thinking about wine growing. So you're growing grapes to make fine wine, not just growing grapes to hit a certain yield, you know, to have a certain Brix. It's all about how is it going to impact for the wine. So that's why, you know, for us, we do all our farming in-house. We don't contract it out. And that really allows us to have the precision and detail in the day-to-day farming.
You have a guy that's been with you for many years that lives on the property, right?
Yes, Edgar. Edgar is our vineyard manager. He's been with us
since
2014.
So that's in-house, as you said.
Yeah. So he supervises our crew of seven guys.
Very, very cool. Talk to me. We got to take a break soon, but talk to me about cellar practices because, like I said, you're meticulous in the field. In the cellar, are we similar? Are we low interventionists? You know, what are we doing down there?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, the nice part of having being able to, you know, farm at such a high level is that you have a great ingredients to work with. So it's more about, you know, guiding it and not screwing it up in a sense.
Right.
So it's pretty, I would say we're pretty minimal interventionalists. But of course, if there is a problem, we will always, you know, step in. But it's more about guiding along the fermentations and allowing each vintage to really express itself.
When you say if there's a problem, you'll step in, I mean, year in, year out, do you run into problems or just every now and then?
It's pretty rare. And that's the other thing been interesting. Yeah. With the biodynamic farming is, you know, since we started and since we've been pushing more towards using our own yeast, native yeast and indigenous yeast, we've seen had zero issues with fermentations. They've all gone really smoothly. So it's been, very beneficial in that way.
Now, we talked about this a little earlier. And, you know, tell me about you. You know, now that you're the person focusing on pretty much everything, is there any shift in the style? You know, when I talk to you about vision, is it stay the course? Is restrain a word you think about? Are there changes that you feel you want to do? I mean, the biodynamic thing is huge, you know, staying sort of low intervention. But is there anything else, you know, that you want to do winemaking stylistically, field and cellar?
For me, I mean, of course, it's naturally with each, like we said before, you know, with each person who takes over and is guiding the wines each year and making them, it's going to be inevitably different. That's natural progression.
So now it's Andy Erickson still?
No, it's me.
Right. What am I saying? Yeah. It shifted from Andy to you. Do you still
Andy's
work with...
Andy still consults with us, so...
Right.
It's been, it's... For me, it's... I really appreciate having his opinion and guidance as well.
Right. So I deviated from the question. So is there anything that... you feel stylistically, you know, that you're doing or you want to change?
I think, slowly. It's not so much, you know, that I want to put my handprint on.
Yeah, I
wines,
don't see it as that.
But
I see it more as what's best for the wine.
Right. So I think there's been a small changes, you know, in barrel selection. I started working with Amphora as a way to add more complexity to the wines without adding more oak impact.
Did you limit?
I mean, definitely.
Did you limit the amphora to, you know, just Colina or kept it away from Maya or doing it with the regular, you know, how are you using something like amphora?
I mean, like with anything in family business, you have to do the slow infiltration, not the shock factor. So I started with, one Cabernet, one Cab Franc lot. And in 18, the Cabernet went into the, to our estate cab. And then 19, the two amphora went into the cab. And then for 20, actually, there's one that made it, that went into Maya. Every year putting a little bit higher.
Do you like the results so far?
Really happy with the results. Yeah.
So it's something that you'll continue to work with.
Yes. Yeah. We have now three per vintage. So yeah, it's been very successful for us.
That's significant. So those are some changes and tweaks that definitely have an effect. Anything else?
I mean, I would say it's a, you know, I like pushing things a little bit earlier than other generations of winemakers. So slowly each year, kind of dialing back the pick dates. Also now, because we have fire season in addition to the four seasons, there's less incentive or reward in the risk of waiting. So it's, and I, you know, it's not like I just pick out an earlier brick. Like we just find, you know, times where we find that the grapes are ready at a lower bricks. And that's, you know, advantageous to.
So I don't want to talk about like bigger wines, unctuous picking later, or more restrained wines picking earlier. Yeah. But that when you pick, you're moving away from what you've done, sort of has an effect on the wine, and it gets you closer to the type of wines you want to make, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Nice. We have to take a quick break. We're talking to Maya Della Valle from Della Valle Vineyards. When we come back, I want Maya to just talk a little about, you know, where the vineyards are. I want to talk about, you know, the wines that we've kind of led up to. And then I want to talk to you about something exciting, which is your DVO project. And I also have to subject you to our wine list. And you were kind enough. And I heard it wasn't easy because Jersey as a wine state sucks. You sent me some wine to taste. So we're talking to Maya Della Valle. You're listening to the Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Support for this episode comes from Team Pennsylvania, hosting the Pennsylvania Hemp Summit, with two events in 2022 that offer a place for farmers, professionals, investors, and policymakers to learn and connect, while providing an occasion to network and grow the businesses that comprise the region's hemp industry. The Pennsylvania Hemp Summit aims to increase the Commonwealth's shared knowledge and resources in order to inspire innovative investments and to form transformative partnerships in the hemp industry. Join us for our upcoming trade show, reception, and investor pitch competition in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on April 26th to 27th, and again on November 8th and 9th for educational sessions, a trade show, and reception. Register to attend or get involved by exhibiting or sponsoring. Details at pahempsummit.com.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Maya Della Valle. Maya is in charge of wine growing and winemaking at her eponymous family winery, Della Valle Vineyards. I want to talk to you quickly. I don't want to take a lot of time, but when you described earlier that, you know, the plot of land is in this high spot and it overlooks the valley, I mean, that alone is a great picture. But quickly tell me about, so you're farming on what type of soil? Is the soil fairly similar throughout the plots? Does that little elevation, you know, have an effect on the climate? Do you face a certain way exposure-wise? You know, then I want to talk to you about the grapes. You know, you're basically working with red grapes. So give me a quick primer on that.
Mm-hmm. So elevation-wise, we're at the top of this bench, 500 feet above the valley floor, so a really hillside profile of fruit. It is a western-facing slope, so we get long hours of sunlight, but it's mitigated by the marine influence we get from the San Pablo Bay. So every day in the afternoon, we get a nice breeze that flows through. And soil-wise, the land was formed about 4 million years ago as a result of a landslide that came from the top of Pritchard Hill down through where we are down to the valley floor. And so the soils are this very red, iron-rich, rocky soil. The rock in particular is an andesitic basalt. And it actually even varies within our 20-acre vineyard. So you have, on the farther east side of the property, this deeper, redder, kind of friendlier soils, I would say, that makes wines that are fresh in acidity and really linear. And then on the face of the slope on the west side, it's extremely rocky. We always have rocks resurfacing in this every year. Right. So my mom jokes that we grow rocks and then we grow grapes because sometimes it really feels like that.
That's funny.
Yeah. And it's a mix of clay and loam depending on where you are in the vineyard.
Right. Which makes a very distinct wine. Let's talk about grapes. Like I said, you're really a red wine specialist. I would say Cabernet Sauvignon is the wheelhouse. But I'm curious, you know, there's five Bordeaux blending varietals. I'm curious why, I guess, your parents settled on Cab Franc as the primary second blending or as the secondary blending grape. So tell me about, you know, the grapes, because most of the wines are composed of those grapes.
Yes. So, I mean, in the beginning, it was certainly trial and error. We had Merlot in the beginning. That was the first grape to go. It was just way far too warm here for Merlot. And we had Cabernet Sauvignon, and then Cabernet Franc was recommended to us to plant. And it did exceedingly well from the beginning. And so when my mom did replant, she decided to add more Cabernet Franc because we did, we love working with it so much. So about 30% of the vineyard is planted to Cab Franc today, in addition to a half acre of Petit Verdot. So those are the three, work with three out of the five Bordeaux varietals. But right. I mean, Cabernet in the 80s, that was, Cabernet is king and still is king today. So that was an obvious choice to plant. But yeah, the Cabernet Franc came recommended to my parents to start out with. And it just, from the beginning, was, like I mentioned, was did so well. And we decided to keep it going.
Right. So you have this gorgeous vineyard, you said 20 acres, this red volcanic soil, predominantly Cab Sauvignon, Cab Franc next, and then some Petit Verdot. So let's quickly go down the list of wines from top to bottom. Maya, which was named after you, is really the premier cuvée of the winery, would you say?
Yes. Yes, and that's our specialty.
Tell me about the blend there.
So when they the first vintage was 88, and they decided to do something unique, which was to make it a red blend and not a Cabernet Sauvignon. So the base is always Maya's Cabernet Sauvignon, which is our best block of Cabernet, and it's blended. They decided to blend it with a high percentage of Cab Franc. So it was 55-45 Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, which now it's changed a little bit as we changed the way that we blend, but still always the base is Maya's Cab, and it's still, you know, 30-40% more now of Cab Franc.
And that's the Maya block, which year in, year out, the grapes are pulled from there.
Yes.
Then you make, we'll get to the wine you don't make every year, but then you make a estate Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yes.
I would assume vintage and blending, you know, because of vintage, blending and everything varies.
It does, but yeah, we have, I mean, there are the base blocks, though, that now become very distinct each year for the Cabernet. And that too, we like to put a little bit of the Cab Franc and sometimes the Petit Verdot mix it in as well to the
blend. But would you say very high percentage of Cab Sauv in that?
Oh yeah. It's always, you know, about 75%. Never 90%, actually. I think most is 85%.
Oh, okay. All right. So that's a nice, so the aromatics and all the other nuances of those grapes participate. And then what you make Kalina, which is a little more accessible price-wise. When did you first start making that?
So my mom created that wine in 2007 after we had finished replanting the vineyard. And that was because we had obviously a lot of young vines. And while most were coming back online that were suitable for the Cabernet or for Maya, there was others that were making very fruit forward and fresh wines, but kind of lacking the depth and structure, I would say, for more serious wines. So she decided to create Colina, which means hill. And our last name means of the valley. So it means hill of the valley, which we sit on. And it's always been a red blend. So because especially now the vines are back in full swing and with some age. So it's now just comes down to the assembly of the blend that we create to make Colina in the same style that is still fresh and approachable. And it's a great introduction to our brand because it is a lower price point, but the farming is the same and the winemaking is the same.
So as Bordeaux does, a second wine, that's kind of your second wine, right? All right.
Yeah.
And then you do a wine that you don't necessarily bottle every year, MDV. Am I right about that?
Yeah. So that's
doesn't MDV stink of Maya Della Valle's initials?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, you didn't have enough of this?
That's what I said to my mom. I was like, okay, so now my first name, my last name, and my initials are all on wine. I mean, enough.
Yeah, really.
But yeah, the MDV is we don't produce every year, and that's only available through our mailing list. And that's just a barrel selection of Maya's Cabernet. So that's 100% Cab. And we'll bottle like 3 or 4 barrels of it.
So if you look at the past 10 years, how many MDVs did you make? Ballpark.
We've made 3 vintages.
Okay, so it's fairly infrequent. All right, so that, am I missing anything on the Della Valle lineup?
No, you covered it all.
All right, so we're running out of time, but we have time. Remember I told you we want to do the wine list and we want to taste some wine and talk about it. But I think this is very exciting and I love the people that you're working with. You have a project called DVO. I'm guessing that's Della Valle Ornellaia.
That is correct.
Okay. So it's a new project of yours with Ornellaia, which, like your wine, is considered, you know, one of the more highly regarded wines in the world. You know, consistent, terrific, sought after. Axel Heinz has been their winemaker. You're also working with their CEO, Giovanni. Tell me, I mentioned in the intro that you did, you know, work at Ornellaia. So I'm guessing you met these people. But tell me how the project came about and the wine that you're making.
Yeah, so Ornellaia actually used to be partially owned by the Mondavi family. So there was a tie to Napa beforehand. Yeah, before. So my mom actually had gotten to know the team when they would come to Napa and was very friendly with them. And Axel would also come every other year. We used to host an international Cabernet symposium through the Oakville Wine Growers. So Cabernet producers from all over the world would come for the symposium. So he also had, you know, this affinity and curiosity about Napa. And then, of course, I went to work for him in 2013. I had a great experience. I learned a lot from him. And we kept in touch. And I actually coincidentally ended up going to the same graduate school in Bordeaux that he had gone to.
Agroscience?
It's called Bordeaux. Yeah, Bordeaux Science Agro. Yeah, it used to be called Anita, but anyway, I don't know why they changed the name, but that's another story. Right. And so he became my mentor for my thesis and project, and it just kind of came about naturally in conversation. You know, this is curiosity, make wine and Napa, like, what if we made wine together? And At first, I was thinking, well, I was like,
when was that seed planted? Yeah.
That was in 2015.
Okay, so a couple of years after
first you started talking about it, yeah.
And like you just said, you'd rather be doing it in Italy, but he wanted to do it here. All right,
so go ahead. Which was fun. I mean, it's been a lot of fun as well because it's opened my eyes to a lot of other areas of the Napa Valley, which I was not familiar with, and discovering, you know, these new sites and soils and microclimates is just like, you know, in the span of half hour drive away is pretty impressive. So we started researching and selecting sites together. And obviously now I do the day-to-day being here in Napa, but Axel normally is coming about 3 times a year and tasting the wines and looking at the vineyards together. So it's very much made in a collaborative way. So the first official release is the 2018. Which we
is
made
that
about
in the market
cases
now?
It is. We did a release.
How many cases did you say?
400.
Okay, that's small.
Yeah.
So what's I kind of know the answer, but I need you to walk me through this. What's the difference between Dalla Valley and DVO? The only thing I could come up with is sites, you know, maybe you shifted towards a little cooler areas, which may have an effect on the type of grape, which if you're picking early, you told me earlier, maybe these cooler sites play into your, you know, taste palette. What's the difference?
I mean, the difference is it's made in a very collaborative way. So the way we make those wines and those lots are very different than how we work with our fruit. You know, the tannin profile and extraction is completely different. The fermentations are treated in a different way. Barrel selection is different because Axel and I work very closely on doing those, making those decisions together.
So almost every element is different, you know, from barrel.
Yeah, it is. And that was the point.
Tannin profile.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. We wanted to make something distinctly different from Dalla Valley and Ornellaia, but something that still reflects, you know, both of our individual know-hows and what we do at our own respective estates and then combine it together to make something new together.
So I'll probably ask you this at the end too, but DVO, limited amount of wine made. Mm-hmm. How is it available? Is it mailing list? Is there some retail? You know, people go, Maya Dalla Valley, Naoko Dalla Valley, Axel Hines. Like, how do I get my hands on that?
Right.
Although it's not your mom, it's you, but you're your mom's kid.
Yeah, whatever. But she still is very involved as well, more from a periphery standpoint. But we sell in New York and California through distributor, and then we have a mailing list. So we have a website, dvowine.com, where people can sign up for the mailing list and then receive the 19 allocation, which will come out in the fall.
Okay. We'll remind people at the end of the show. Mm-hmm. All right. I need to shift to a thing called the wine list. We do this thing called the wine list. We ask all our guests 5 questions. We ask everyone the same 5 questions. We've been doing this for over 200 guests. You're not escaping from it. I want you to be spontaneous. Let's not spend a ton of time because I want to spend a few minutes tasting the Kalina with you. So, and I will post these answers on our websites, you know, when we promote the show. What is Maya drinking now? What's in your fridge? What are you curious about, you know, besides your wines? What's interesting you?
So what's actually in my fridge right now, are a few wines that were made by an old intern of ours who's now the assistant winemaker to Graham McDonald. His name's Reed Griggs, and it's a new wine that he's going to release, I believe, this year called
what type
Tidings.
Of wine?
It's so there's a Santa Barbara Syrah.
Okay, and, I love that.
Yeah, and then
and it's Tidings, T-I-D-I-N-G-S.
Yeah.
So Syrah and a Cab Sauv. And what's his name again?
His name is Reed Griggs.
Okay. Let's look out for him. Anything else?
There's always, well, I always joke it takes a lot of beer to make good wine. So sometimes at the end of the day, having an ice cold beer.
Pick beer as an answer. We're going to stop there. All right. Second question. Okay. Maya DV's favorite wine and food pairing. Not what you think is a good one, but what do you like? And it's obviously something you don't eat every night, every week. But what's that? You know, you got this food in front of you and the wine and you go, this is just good.
So this is going to sound really basic, but I love...
Wait. You're not allowed to say wine and champagne and oysters, but go ahead.
I was going to say champagne and popcorn.
Okay. I love that. I mean, not the first time, but not common, but one of the great ones. You know, champagne and salty...
That's
great. You know what ain't bad either? Champagne... potato chips and caviar.
Now, that's what my mom's favorite pairing.
You and your boyfriend, what about this?
Oh yeah, that's our favorite snack is popcorn. So
you guys are very fancy.
Yeah.
All right. Third question. Now I'm sure you're pretty busy, but you're young and you get around and all that. Do you have a favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And when I ask you that, I'm not asking you to rank them or, you know, this is your only place. Just what comes to mind, you know, as a good place that you walk into, the wine list is cool, the people are knowledgeable, the vibe in the place is nice. You could do Napa in your travels. You could throw something out at me. Does anything come to mind? And if you mention something, like I said, if somebody comes up to you and says, why didn't you mention me? The answer was, he didn't ask me my favorite. He just asked me some places that I think are cool. So how do you answer that?
Well, one of my favorite wine bars in Bordeaux when I was living there is called Au Quatre Coins du Vin. So it's like from the four.
You have to spell that for me because I post it.
Okay. It's right now?
Yes.
It's AUX.
Okay.
And then you can just do the number 4.
Okay.
And then coins, spelled like coins, plural.
Right, right.
And then du.
Right.
And then van, V-I-N.
Okay, that's a good one. Anything else stateside?
Stateside, I love Valley Bar and Bottle in Sonoma.
Okay. Nice to hear you pick a Sonoma place over Napa. All right, we'll leave it at those two. Fourth question, favorite all-time wine. When I started the show many years ago, I asked the question, fishing for an answer about what was the most expensive, rare, famous wine you ever tasted. I don't give a crap about that anymore. I care about a wine in your lifetime that's a favorite, that had an impact on how you view wine, that changed your thinking, that was a gateway. Is there any wine or two that has done that to you?
I would say from a white wine, Silex, when it was made by Didier Dagenaud, was a life-changing wine for me because I never had a Sauvignon Blanc.
All right, so it's a Dagenaud Sauv Blanc. What year are we talking around?
I believe it was 06.
Ballpark. When? 06?
06.
Okay, so when you had that, it got you thinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Funny, you're a red wine maker that was influenced by a white wine. I like that.
I guess, you know, grass is always greener on the other side.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. All right, last question, and this is going to be a hard question, but too bad. so the question is, we ask all our guests to recommend the best wine around $15, $20, $22 retail. We ask them to recommend a white or a red. You could recommend categories like Muscadet is a terrific white wine that's cheap. And I would set this up by saying a couple things. You are a red wine specialist. You are a premium winemaker. You are in Napa Valley. So tough tooties to you for answering this. But if you had to recommend to my kids who are like in their 20s or whatever, where they can't bring crappy supermarket wine to a party or as a gift, but they don't have $40, $50, what are some cool wines that you can imagine, you know, that wow in that $15, $20, $22 price range? Can you think of anything, or did I stump the crap out of you?
I would say anything with a Kermit Lynch back label in that price point, you can't go wrong.
So that's a great answer. Anything that Kermit
Lynch imports.
That's a great answer.
Is that okay?
No, that's a great answer because, you know, he's been around a long time and he's curated great wines and he has wines in those price range. And it goes back to the old argument that if you find a wine store or a distributor that meets your sensibilities, then they have the stuff that you want. And Kermit Lynch is that. Now, just to break that down a little, are there any types of wines in there, like Beaujolais or?
Is always a hit. But is there even Beaujolais at that price point anymore? I feel like I love Beaujolais.
It used to be. You could probably get it for $25 for the Village and what about like a cheap, not cheap, an inexpensive white?
I would say, Muscadet is always, or a Picoult is always.
So we agree on that. Yeah. And Kermit has some good. That's a good answer. Very skillful, coy answer. I like that. You should be able to give me an answer like that with two master's degrees. So kudos to you.
Yeah, I know. A lot of expensive pieces of paper.
That's right. All right. We got to wrap the show up. But before we wrap up, we do a thing called the weekly wine sip. And I put you out of your comfort zone and made you send me wine. So you and I are going to taste and evaluate on air the 2019 Colina Dalla Valley, which we talked a little about. What more can you tell me about this wine that we didn't discuss, you know, particular vintage, blending, whatever?
Well, 19 does have one of the amphora age lots in it. So it's a Cabernet Franc age amphora. So it makes up less than 5% of the blend.
The Franc or the amphora?
The amphora. It's about 40% Cabernet Franc in the blend. So it's 50% Cabernet Sauvignon, and then the remainder is Petit Verdot. So it has all three of the grapes that we produce. 19 is a great vintage, a pretty rainy spring. That was probably one of the rare years we actually had any kind of mildew pressure, but very easy to mitigate. Yeah.
Right.
Because we had pretty late rains in the spring. But and a warm summer to offset that, and very dry afterwards. So,
overall a good vintage 19 or trying or
a great vintage. Yeah.
Great vintage.
No,
okay.
It's a great vintage.
So that's a 19 is a buy.
It's definitely a buy. I mean, every vintage is a buy, but you know, we have more consistency vintage to vintage in the Napa Valley, due to the climate. But I love the 19s. They're, you know, very fruit forward. They're fresh. They're approachable. They're, I would say, more charming than the 18s. The 18s are a little bit more broody and austere. Takes a little bit more time to understand.
Descriptors, we're not talking just about Colina. We're talking about the vintage or Colina.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So everything you described falls into that 19. All right. So what I want to do is I want to throw a little of this juice over my tongue and I want to talk to you about it. All right.
Okay.
So first, before we do that, let's look at the color. You know, typically I would think that it's got that dark, you know, brooding purple, you know, fairly dark edges, even though it lightens up. Agree?
Yes. Agreed.
All right. Now, nose, I suck at descriptors. You're the one with the two masters. Let's put this up to our schnoz. Give it a sniff. And tell me your descriptors on this particular wine and vintage.
So the 19 Colina on the nose, like I mentioned before, it's very fruit forward. So you get a lot of red fruits.
I get mostly red. Even though it's this dark, you know, wine, it leans more red than dark fruits. I agree there. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it's a little bit more playful on the nose than I would say the Cabernet and the Meyer are going to be a little bit denser.
Okay, playful may be the first time we ever had that descriptor. Go ahead.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
so, all right, so
what else? Tasting descriptors get so boring. Got to, you know, spice it
up. No, I love that. That's why I singled it out. All right, so definitely red fruits. I get florally, you know, some flower.
Yeah, there's some floral tones there. And then, like, you can feel the influence of the Cabernet Franc with some of, like, the dried herbs on the back end as well.
Right. So question, when we talk Cab Franc, what Cab Franc brings to the table blending wise, would you say one of the first things is aromatics?
I think it brings a lot of aromatics.
What else?
It just adds, for me, it creates a little bit more lightness in what can be a very tannic and linear Cabernet. It just broadens the wine when you taste it.
Which I love about your wines, because, you know, these are big wines, but it kind of, you know, does a nice thing to that. All right, so let's move to mouthfeel. We throw it back over the tongue. And I wouldn't say in a good way that it's unctuous, but it's a nice full mouthfeel, like a medium plus minimum.
Yeah. And that's the Petit Verdot playing with the mid palate. So
yeah,
Petit Verdot is great for blending to add a little bit of weight to the wine.
It's a great mouthfeel. It's mouth-filling, but like I said, it's not like some of these unctuous syrupy Bordeaux or even Napa wines and all of that. All right, so let's move to the final thing, the palate. You're going to help me with this. Does the palate reflect a lot of the nose descriptors, and what other descriptions can you give me on the palate?
Yeah, I think it matches a lot on what
red
you
berry.
Smell on the glass, red berry, but I think there's a little bit more spiciness too from the oak,
yes.
Especially on the finish.
Not oaky though.
Not oaky, no, but that's, you know, when oak is done right, it's meant to enhance the wine, not overpower it, right? So
I think what I like about
it's only 60% new, so.
That's great. What I like about it is, you know, when I take a taste in the mouth, I actually feel it go up my nose a little, you know, which is nice.
Got a little retronasal action.
Yeah, versus, you know, just, you know, smelling it and all that. It's a beautiful wine, and, you know, not to make any light of anything, it's your entry level wine, but I mean, it's as good as anything. What's in your mind perfect pairings for this kind of wine?
That wine's pretty versatile, I would say, in terms of what you can pair with it. I mean, yeah, obvious choice. What a lot of people like to pair it with is red meat.
Right.
But I think it pairs with chicken too, you know, with some kind of sauce on it, can go perfectly well with also.
Yeah. So it's pretty versatile. I think it is versatile, 'cause it's not that over the top Napa Cab. It's got a lot of that, you know, character where you can put anything. So do we like this wine? I like this wine. I'm very surprised. Because I wouldn't call it restrained, but it's far from this over the top. I love the blends. I love the Verdot and the Franc. You're very happy with the way this wine came out?
Yeah, we're happy. No complaints.
Yeah, it's very good. So that's the 2019 Colina Dalla Valle. It's their Napa Valley red wine. We talked about the blend. All right, Maya, we have to wrap up. I want to get some info from you, but let me just do a quick wrap up. And then I want to, just like I said, get some info from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify. Actually, iTunes is now Apple Podcasts. Or wherever you get your pods, subscribe, because when you wake up tomorrow morning and you put your earbuds on, Maya will be in bed with you. That won't happen if you don't subscribe. So please subscribe. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation, on Instagram, we're at SBenRuby, on Twitter, we're at BenRuby, but you can get to both of those by using our hashtag, The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we will post Maya's wine list. She gave us some great suggestions. And I will give you all the info on the weekly wine sip, which was the 19 Colina, on all our social media sites in the next week. Maya, fill in the blanks here. Where can we find you and your wines on social media and online? So if I am intrigued by this show and I want to get these wines, I'm going to guess you may have a waiting list, but where do I go?
Yes. So you can sign up on our waiting list at dallavallevineyards.com.
dallavallevineyards.com.
Yes. Vineyards, plural.
Vineyards, with an S. And that'll bring you to the site and sign up and be patient. As we mentioned, the wine is available retail online and at restaurants, right?
Yes.
Correct. And do you do social media on behalf of yourself and the winery?
Yes, we have Instagram pages for both myself and for the winery.
So you are, which is yours?
Mine is Maya DV.
Okay. At Maya DV.
Yes.
And then the winery, the vineyard?
The winery is at Dalla Valle Vineyards.
Okay. So those would be fun to follow after hearing these shows. All right, Maya, I want to thank you very much. Thank you to our guest, Maya Dalla Valle. Thank you to our engineer, Kevin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.